previously on Debug, we began the Nitin Ganatra trilogy, the former director of iOS apps at Apple, by talking about his early career, how he got hired working on System 7 and Carbon. Now we're going to dive into OS 10 and eventually iOS.
So how do you, like, so what happened with Carbon? Like, you eventually you transitioned out of that group.
Yes.
A very successful project. Right.
Yeah.
Like, we would not have a Mac today without Carbon. And you know, as a guy that's basically like an app kit OpenStep guy, or that's at least my vector into the platform, there's no denying that Carbon is really what kind of made it a viable platform for a long time. So, you know, good job. problem solved. What happens next?
Yeah. Thank you. Thank you for saying that. It was, I mean, yeah, I agree. It was, I mean, I think it was critical at that time. And, you know, you can look at it technically and say, oh, well, you know, all you did was hide some symbols and expose some new symbols and, you know, covers for some of these APIs. But yes, I mean, it was, I believe that it was critical. And I think that, you know, history, you know, has sort of borne that out. So, yeah.
I mean, I think at the time I would probably have been one of those people that was holding their nose up about, like, oh, it's a Carbon app. But
yes,
truth is, yeah, it's a Carbon app. Like, and it's Photoshop. Guess who uses Photoshop? A lot of people use Photoshop or Word or what have you. You know, hell, the Finder, iTunes, yeah, that, like,
and there was definitely, it, you know, for, it, yes, I agree. I mean, there were some things about it that, you know, I think that, you know, I wish that it was a little bit more integrated into the system sooner, you know, than it was or felt like it was integrated. In other words, you know, when you launched, you know, Internet Explorer, you know, which was the browser, yeah, at the time for the Mac. When you launched Internet Explorer on Mac OS X, you knew you were in a Carbon app. You know, you had, you know, there was the, you know, the text rendered a little bit different. It was pretty ugly compared to Cocoa. You know, if you were using, you know, Office, you know, it took a little longer to launch and maybe it didn't, well, maybe it didn't, but it was, you know, when it came up, you definitely felt like you were, it was something different than the rest of, you know, the system. And
yeah, I think it took years to get services working in them.
Right.
There was a bunch. There was a bunch of stuff that was like, hey, this is clearly a Carbon app. On the other hand, these are like marquee apps that, like, if you didn't have them on your system, as well be the Amiga running on a PowerPC. Like, it's kind of pointless.
Definitely, definitely. And that was, you know, and we, you know, and on the Carbon team, I think we, you know, we really held on to that. We used that to kind of, you know, keep us going too. I mean, because,
yeah,
you know, even at the time, it wasn't like Carbon was sort of held up as, you know, angels sing when you see a Carbon app, right? It was kind of...
No, it was always sort of a necessary evil, which is kind of a downer to be on.
Exactly,
on the team,
exactly.
Yeah.
Right, yeah. You don't want to, you know, work on something that you're, you know, everybody just kind of begrudgingly accepts that, you know, well, yeah, it has to be here because things would be so much worse without it. You know, who wants to work on that? You want to work on, oh my God, this thing is fantastic, you know.
It's kind of funny. I'm just realizing that you were on the 7 team, which was kind of the necessary evil team.
Yeah.
Then you currently did Carbon. So you're an underappreciated fella is what I'm saying.
Well, I never, yeah. Thankfully, it never really felt that way for me, but yeah, who knows what I'd be doing. But eventually, yes, I did transition over from, you know, the lead on Carbon Lib for OS 8 and, you know, to just working on in the Carbon team, working for John Urochi, who reported to Scott Forstall directly. Mm-hmm. And at that time, you know, and that was long before OS 10 shipped. You know, I think I made that transition in 1999, I think is when I first started working for John full time. Okay. And I was working on the core services, you know, components of Carbon. So, yeah, in particular, the file manager, resource manager, you know, kind of those low level, you know, sort of bits, some process manager in there, things like that. And so that was So the challenges there were that we really wanted to have this sort of single unified API. You know, at the time, Avi Tabanian was the VP of macOS development, and he was a very strong believer in heterogeneous systems and working well with, you know, fitting into existing sort of networks of computers and things like that.
Yeah. I mean, hence the insistence on file extensions and a bunch of other things.
Exactly. Yeah. You know, getting rid of, you know, resource forks. You know, resource forks were sort of seen as this weirdo Mac thing that no other file system had. You know, later Windows added it, but, you know, to NTFS they had multiple streams, but it was, even then it was kind of a bizarro thing. And
yeah, I was two-headed, and invariably when you try to zip something up, forget it, and everything would break anyway on all of these systems.
Right. So, yeah.
It's a nice idea. It's a really nice idea, but, you know, keeping things simple is a noble goal too.
Right. Well, you know, it's interesting too. I mean, and at the time I remember, I mean, there was a lot of, you know, there was this tech note that went out, or, maybe a year or two later after OS X had shipped, that was describing, you know, kind of the way that people should be developing for the Mac, you know, and it was some of these things, right? Like, don't use resource forks and use file extensions and, different things
that. It's the one that gives John Syracuse a heartache every time. He's probably got it tattooed. It's probably his one tattoo. And it's just the number of that tech note, because it's basically like, it's effectively says, don't be a Mac.
Right. Exactly.
Yeah.
But you know, I think one of the things that's sort of built in, like kind of a built-in base assumption to, you know, that strong reaction is that the file system is this user-visible thing.
Yes.
So because it's this user-visible thing, we don't want to show ugliness, you know, implementation details like file extensions. You know, instead we would want to have, you know, this alternate way of typing and, you know, typing files or giving files a certain type.
But ultimately, I mean, what the user interacts with is a projection of, you know, bits on a disk, effectively. So you can alter that projection in a user-friendly way without necessarily having the file system itself be, you know, either case-sensitive or insensitive or have the file extensions or the resource forks.
Exactly. And so even though, I was in kind of this weird position where, you know, I was the guy who was implementing a lot of the, you know, these file manager calls, you know, and implementing, you know, some of the resource manager, you know, we had this file mapped resource manager as well at the time that I had, you know, written a lot of code for. And so even though I was, you know, working at, you know, developing these things and, you know, getting them ready to ship with, you know, OS X, you know, 0.0, you know, it's still, you know, I could appreciate that. You know, maybe the fact that, you know, you're actually showing a user, you know, the physical representation or something that's very close to, you know, the actual representation on disk and expecting them to make sense of that, maybe that's the weird part here. You know, maybe it's not, you know, maybe hiding the file extensions and, you know, or doing these other things, maybe that's not so, I mean, they're weird on both sides. And to kind of assume that, you know, that a user should be able to just go and look at, you know, if you use a low level interface like, you know, get dir entries or, you know, get catalog info or whatever.
Sure.
You know, and the values and the strings that you get back from that API should be purely reflected to the user. And those should be things that are, you know, what the user manipulates. Well, isn't that kind of a weird thing all on its own? I mean, that's sort of a weird assumption to kind of build in and to kind of base your ideas around, you know, how a Mac should be and how Macs should be used. That always felt like it was kind of a, you know, kind of, it was not a real strong, you know, rationalization for why, you know, we shouldn't have file extensions. That felt weird, but just in another way. So I could really, I could really appreciate, you know, that, you know, and by the way, users are just fine typing .com, you know, when they want to go to Apple, you know?
Right.
And now maybe, you know, maybe Safari helps them these days, and, you know, some of their, you know, websites do, but while the web was getting wildly popular, people didn't have a, you know, humans are very adaptable and they're very understanding, and, you know, in some ways they kind of, you know, gloss over some of these things that we see as ugliness. And I mean, I guess maybe that's not an excuse for, you know, that's not to say, well, you know, humans should be able to, you know, change their own memory, you know, their own RAM, and, you know, it should all be user serviceable. But at the same time, you know, let's be a little bit more careful on, you know, what we think are sort of base assumptions of, you know, of the Mac OS experience, because there's some weirdness that's just largely traditional as well.
Yep, that's a terrific point. And I'm going to play that back for Syracuse next time he yells at me about something.
Yeah, I'm pretty sure at this point we've, you know, kicked a hole through this dead horse, you know, of
yeah, exactly. right. So did you, so yeah. So what happens after that? Like, where do you go from that group?
Yeah. Okay. So, so I worked on, Carbon, specifically on the file systems and low level, you know, Carbon Core, it was called, on John's team. We shipped 10.0, we shipped 10.1.
Sorry, not to interrupt you. Well, yeah. But I'm going to, but how did shipping 10.0 feel?
Oh, it was awesome. I mean, it was really, you know, in many ways, that was sort of the first OS that I had worked on that went from, you know, something that was very, very different, you know, when we had started to, sure, you know, when we had finished, right? Like in release engineering, it was all, you know, we always had something that was, you know, we had 7.5 or we had 7.5.2, and now we're going to add, you know, some new facilities or new features or fix some horrible bugs and call it 7.5.3. You know, it was sort of a continuation, right? It was release management. And so 10.0 was really, well, I mean, I guess maybe that's not true. There was major functionality that I had shipped in 8.0 and 8.5, but it really wasn't the kind of the multi-year, you know, long haul project that 10.0 was.
Yeah, it's a reboot, right? Even if you count what did ship, going to blank on the name, OS X Server 1.0. Like it was basically Rhapsody with a OS 8 look. Like that did ship, but it had like a different, had like a Mach 2.5 kernel, had a bunch of other stuff. Like it was an odd beast.
Right. Yeah. Exactly. Yeah. And then to turn around and ship 10.0 with Aqua and you know, this Carbon based Finder and things like that. There was a lot of learning that went in. I think, you know, I think one of the biggest lessons that I kind of learned from that time that I, you know, sort of carried on later was, you know, was the value in you know, having something working or getting something working and then incrementing on it, you know, or improving it, while, you know, continuing to keep, you know, the things that were working, you know, while keeping those things working. So in other words, I mean, it's funny, this sounds, you know, when I say it, it sounds very almost simplistic and almost like, well, duh, that's of course, why wouldn't you do? What are you saying? You want to deliberately like break the world? And, you know, but really, I think, you know, there are a lot of software projects that are run where, you know, yes, you've got a working system and then you go in and you push the patient on the, you know, on the operating table, and, you know, you open them up and, you know, parts are everywhere and, you know, and who knows what the hell's going on, and you hope you can stitch it all back together and hope that they're better off later on, you know, as opposed to, you know, getting something working and kind of, you know, just massaging it and improving it and making sure that, yeah, if there are things where you really just have to do just a big refactor, that you've got a plan in place to not screw half the world, you know, while you're in the middle of your refactoring. Mm-hmm. You know, and to be clear, I mean, there was a lot of, you know, I mean, tons and tons of brand new code, of course, that had to go into 10.0, but really just the overall theme of, you know, getting something working and keeping it working is kind of a, you know, that's the most important thing to a project. You know, that's almost more important than meeting your deadlines on the new stuff that you're working on, you know, is making sure that you can keep something working and keep everybody else productive. And you know, and again, I sort of credit Bertrand with kind of, you know, having that message and sort of placing a priority on that. You know, and that was how 10.0 went from, you know, Mach 2.5 to 3.0 and, you know, a, you know, this wacky, you know, AppKit based, I don't even remember what the Finder thing was called, but, you know, to the carbon based Finder, you know, there were, at the time, there were all these different, you know, Bertrand loved vectors, you know, and there were these different vectors that we, you know, all these different vectors that sort of represented different efforts that were, that had to take place. And, you know, and just making sure that things were, you know, that there was continuous progress in all of these areas, yet all the while, you know, we have to keep things working. We have to keep it so that, you know, there are, you know, maybe there isn't a stable build every single day, but there's a stable build 3 days, 4 days a week, you know.
Right.
And that was very different from my experience on, you know, from what I saw, at least on the kind of on the outside from Copeland, where, you know, on Copeland, there was, you know, oh, well, we got to go and rewrite the VM system. And then the, you know, the entire program is kind of, you know, on its back for 3 weeks while the VM system gets, you know, gets redone. And then inevitably, you know, once it gets checked in, it's horrible and it doesn't work. And, you know, there's all this work that needs to take place to just get it back to where it was before, let alone, you know, better and, you know, doing all the things that, you know, you promised were going to happen by rewriting it. So, you know, it's not so obvious.
Right. And that's really hard to manage and to sort of coordinate.
Definitely. Definitely.
So you ship, 10.0, 10.1. What happens? 10.2, I guess?
Yeah.
Just going linearly? Yeah. So how long were you in the group for?
I think it was 10.2. Oh boy, let's see. I remember the years, unfortunately. I remember the years more than I remember the releases. I think it was, so 10.1 was Puma. Then I think 10.2 was Jaguar, if I recall.
Jaguar. Yeah.
Jaguar.
Yeah.
Jaguar. So I believe it was shortly after Jaguar that I sort of, you know, I had an itch to kind of move into more of a management type position.
Okay.
You know, and kind of move out of engineering. It was sort of, you know, the cycle around, you know, getting new features, identifying, you know, new things that we want to do, type, you know, get the beginnings of the features in, you know, iterate and make them work better, you know, fix some bugs, you know, and then,
right.
I mean, it was, you know, I had started to kind of experience a pattern around development and I really wanted to, like in some ways, I guess I wanted a little bit more kind of influence. I wanted a little bit more influence over, you know, kind of larger aspects of.
Yeah. Was that born out of frustration?
Not really.
Yeah. Okay.
Oh, go ahead. Sorry.
No. I mean, just I know. So my first management gig, we got a new director of development, and I don't know, something dumb happened. And at one point, I just go into his office and I just rant about everything that's broken. And then he makes me the director of all the programmers. So, which is not what I expected to happen. But, you know, I definitely learned a lesson that day. So sometimes, you know, you get into the management side of stuff purely out of frustration. Like, I'm annoyed. I'm going to basically articulate these issues. And, you know, if you do it in a certain way, somebody just says, well, why don't you fix it? but that didn't happen in your case. So you weren't frustrated. It just appealed to you, like this kind of
the meta
level sort of appealed to you.
Exactly. I think it was really more the desire to have more influence and to try kind of the, you know, another side of you know, software development. It really wasn't. I mean, and don't get me wrong. You know, poor John. You know, my manager at the time, he heard enough ranting from me about, you know, whatever I thought was BS at the time.
Sure.
But that really wasn't the, you know, the motivation. I mean, that was more just, you know, engineers being grumpy and opinionated and things like that. It really was, if I kind of look back, it really was more of a, I wanted to try, I felt like I had, because I had been, working in the, in on the OS in some form or another, mm-hmm. since late 94, and by then it was 2002. So I'd been kind of, even though it was a completely different platform and very different jobs and, and I'd been learning the whole time, but it was 8 years of doing, at a very, broad, kind of stepping back, it was doing a largely similar job. And so I kind of wanted to do something else. And one of the things that appealed to me was having more, a little bit more influence and having a little bit more, the ability to kind of, help define the product itself, as opposed to just implementing what somebody else had defined.
So what was your first management gig?
My first management gig was the Mac OS X mail team, and that was reporting to Scott Forstall, and that was late 2002.
How'd that go? Was it a big leap?
Yes.
Because that is not a small application. That's kind of a big deal. It's one of the, handful, the 8, 9 maybe that ship in the dock by default?
You're right. Right. Yeah, it was definitely a big deal. It was pretty tough. The first 6 months were, I literally became a father the same month that I became a manager at Apple. And
sorry.
Do you have any kids? Do you have any kids?
No, or? I don't. No, I don't. No. I appreciate the stress that the double whammy must have put on you.
It was, exactly. And I certainly didn't plan it that way. I guess in some way I did, but it wasn't like I want to become a father at the same time wildly change my position at work too. And so that was a hard, the first 6 months was very difficult. First, I kind of went from, being generally pretty comfortable with my position and the work that I was doing and the deliverables and things like that to moving into management where I had just no idea what I was doing and the best thing that I was, the best thing I could do in my mind anyway was sort of emulate, kind of the managers that I thought were the best managers that I had ever had. And so that was sort of how I, there were some Apple management courses that were available at that time. And by the way, anybody who's listening at Apple, it's my understanding there are no management courses today. And I think that's a horrible, horrible oversight. I can't imagine why that's happening now. But if it's still true, it's terrible. There needs to be, some formal management training that takes place.
Is it the university stuff that's replacing it?
And maybe it is. But it's my understanding that there is still no, sort of formal management training that's in place. And I'm not even talking about, I got a certificate or I got a, whatever the fuck, but really just, some of the base concepts around situational leadership, and just understanding that, different people on a team need a different kind of manager, and you need to as a manager, you need to appreciate that and put the effort in to make your people successful, and you can't just treat them all the same way. They're not driven by the same things.
Some people need a lot of guidance. Some people don't like to be meddled with, kind of thing.
Yeah. So, it's like different kinds of learners.
Different people, like your best performers are going to feel like they're just screw ups their whole time, and you have to know how to manage them. They're going to be the people who are kind of average or maybe, below average, and they feel like they're rock stars. How do you manage them? I'll give you a hint. You don't manage those two types of people the same way, right? I mean, it's obviously, right? You just can't. And just learning to kind of go through, in a way that's detached from, from your day-to-day job, kind of going through some of those scenarios and understanding some of the techniques that are available. I don't think it needs to be this, this huge course that, with a big old certification program and all this other bullshit, but there needs to be something there. And I've seen too many people, you know, kind of move into management and hop back out of management because, I mean, it's you know,
it's a flounder with them. Yeah,
they flounder, they're frustrated, but also, you know, it is a very different job from being an engineer and you know, you may feel like just because, well, I'm, you know, I interact with my manager and we talk about engineering things, and I could be on that side talking about engineering things with someone like me, so therefore I could move into management. You know, it's really not sort of appreciating how different of a job it is. And
it's wildly different. Like, so, you know, like I said, when I got my first management gig, I thought I was kind of happy. And then, you know, within a month, I've got to deal with, you know, somebody's coming to work and he doesn't smell great. So I need to talk to HR and him and try to work it out. Or, you know, people want bigger dividers around their desks. Or it's one thing to be the technical lead on a project and sort of gather your troops in that way and give technical direction. It's an entirely different thing to manage people in a broader sense, right?
And it's hard too, because like at the end of the day, you used to have product you could show for every workday, and now you spend a lot of time and it's not your product that's done at the end of the day.
Yes. Yes, absolutely. Yeah. Well, and it's interesting you say that, because I mean, that was one of the things that I actually saw as being a parallel with becoming a parent. At around the same time, which was, you know, when your child, you know, takes their first steps or things like that, you know, that's not you taking those steps, you know, but you're very proud of them, you know, kind of on their behalf, right? You didn't stand up and get all, you know, on your wobbly baby legs and whatever and walk across the room, but, you know, but you can be proud of them and you can be encouraging and you can sort of take some, you know, some satisfaction in knowing that, you know, in you can kind of take those accomplishments and in a small way make them your own. You know, now baby steps is kind of a bad example, because it's not like, you know, you had these meetings with your baby and decided how you're going to, you know, put the right foot first and then the left foot, and then, you know, and they ended up doing it and everybody's very happy, which is a little bit closer to how, you know, it works on the engineering management side, right? But the fact remains that, you know, when you're an engineer, it's very, you know, it's been my experience anyway, that it's very satisfying to go from, you know, either a blank file or, you know, something that works but doesn't have the functionality you're about to add, and, you know, going to having that functionality. You know, when you're an engineer, you have something tangible you can point to and you can say, I did that.
Yeah.
You know, the reason you can, you know, make a phone call on that thing is because I worked on the, you know, communications protocol or whatever. You know what I mean?
Mm-hmm.
Like, you know, an engineer can attach themselves to that because they, in a very tangible way, they made that happen. Whereas when you're in management, you know, a lot of it is, hey, how's it going? What are you going to do about, you know, such and such? Have you thought about, you know, these different problems? How is this going to fit into, you know, this larger architecture? You know, and you're kind of, you know, you're kind of, you know, the hope is that you can ask the right questions and kind of prod, you know, people to kind of move in the right direction so that they don't, you know, they don't paint themselves in a corner or end up at a dead end or whatever. But at the end of the day, when they've done that, it's their accomplishment. And, you know, as a manager, you have to sort of take satisfaction in the fact that, well, maybe you helped them kind of get to that good spot, but you didn't actually do the work to get to that good spot yourself. And that can be,
right,
for someone who's an engineer, who's used to that tangible, you know, benefit and sort of seeing that, you know, I did that, that can be a very difficult thing to, you know, frankly, you can get to the end of a project and feel like, well, what the hell did I do? You know, I updated some spreadsheets and I did some, you know, X, Y, and Z, and well, really, couldn't anybody have done that? And, you know, it's, you know, it takes a little bit of self-confidence and a little bit of understanding, you know, of the development process and knowing just kind of what the pitfalls are that you could go through at any point, you know, to kind of get that satisfaction. But it's, you know, at the end of the day, somebody else did the work and you have to be happy with that.
Yeah, it's particularly hard for an engineer, I think, because, well, I don't know, I don't have another perspective, but just sort of that build and run cycle, like the endorphin you get when you write a little bit of code and you run it and you see it working.
Yeah,
that's kind of what drives a lot of people to code in the first place, and management really divorces you from that. Like you don't, there's no action and response. The feedback loop is totally absent.
Exactly.
So did you adjust to that well, or did you like kind of get bummed out for a little bit, or what?
It took a little bit of time. You know, I was, anybody who is on that mail team who might be listening to this now, thank you. Thank you for bearing with me. If you didn't guess, I didn't know what the hell I was doing, but you know, I was, you know, I mean, it was, you know, the mail team was just, you know, it was largely people who were kind of from the next side of things. Yeah. And it was just just an incredible, you know, just very, very intelligent people, very hard workers, and, you know, people who knew what the right thing to do was. And so, you know, for them to have kind of a shitty manager for a while, I think, you know, they were probably the ones who were the most capable of taking on, you know, somebody like that, you know,
So they sculpted you.
Yeah, maybe, probably. Yeah. I think they did. Yeah, that's true. But you know, also, like you said, it was, I mean, it's Mail, you know, and Mail is sort of one of those marquee apps, you know, for OS X. You know, new functionality and new features tend to show up in Mail first, and Mail is kind of used as the, you know, kind of the guide for other apps, you know, that are on the
system. Yeah, I think it's, I really think it's been in almost every WWDC keynote for years. There's always something cool, yeah.
for better or for worse, you know, it could also be very stressful too. when Phil Schiller is getting grumpy to, you know, Scott Forstall because, you know, his pop connection doesn't work well or something like that, you know, it can be a little stressful. And you know, and Scott himself
if Phil Schiller is still using a pop connection, he deserves to be grumpy.
Well,
I'm kidding.
I'm pretty sure he didn't actually have a pop connection. I was just, you know, giving.
I know. I just love it. I just love the notion of like caveman mail.
Talking email.
Yeah.
But so how long? Go ahead. Sorry.
Oh no, but to be clear, Phil Schiller definitely had problems with mail. So
yeah.
You know, and there were lots of issues like that. You know, it was it was this high profile app. Everybody was, you know, using it. I mean, I think that, you know, Steve expected the executive team to use, you know, to use Mail and to write up bugs on it. And, you know, when things didn't work, you know, it wasn't acceptable to go use Entourage. You know, you had to go and, you know, hey, Phil, you have to use Mail. And where it sucks, you have to be very loud and clear on the areas where it sucks and let the engineering team know about it. And,
yeah,
you know, and,
like serious dog fooding, right?
Exactly. Very much so.
And these guys, basically their job revolves around email in a lot of ways. So can't screw that up. Yeah.
Right. Exactly.
So how long were you with Mail?
So I was, I managed the Mail team. About 6 months into managing the Mail team, I also started managing the address book team too. In early 2003, I think was when I picked up the address book team. And I managed both of those until early 2005. We had just finished up the Tiger release of Mail, or the Tiger release, you know, the OS X Tiger release, which had, you know, kind of a new look and feel for the email app. You know, it had Spotlight integration. I think we had threaded views in 10.3. But, you know, there were other refinements that were, you know, kind of coming in all the while, you know, resizable images, you know, different things. You know, we had, I think it was 10.3, we put a brand new, oh no, gosh, maybe that was 10.5, where we had the, you know, we had a new SQLite-based database in Mail.
Well, here I am going to try to second guess you, but yeah, that seems... Seems right. And you know, you had the Mail templates and 10.4. There was a lot of work. Like that app has really evolved a lot over the years.
Yeah. It really evolved a lot, and it was always, you know, it was one of those things where, you know, I kind of wanted it to be, you know, I the thing that we had talked about on the Mail team was, you know, I wanted it to be an app that people would be willing to pay for. But you don't have to pay for it. You get it for free with OS X. You know, it was, you know, but it was one of those things that, you know, it was, God, wouldn't it be great if people, you know, thought this app was so good that they'd be willing to pay for it just kind of as a standalone thing, you know, and that was sort of one of the...
I think in a lot of ways, It was, because it basically just sucked the air out of that market. Like, nobody else really sells an email client anymore, on the Mac at least.
That's interesting. Yeah, I didn't think about that.
Yeah. So it kind of worked. Like, nobody's paying extra to get email anymore because, well, if there's Gmail too, it probably didn't hurt. But mm-hmm. I've always just used Mail. I like it. That's my email client. Like, that's likewise. My Eudora. Yeah, that's the one I go to. Mm-hmm. So, again, good work.
Thank you.
So 2005, what happens?
What happened? Good question. Yeah.
Is this where you get like abducted into a dark room and just locked up for a few years or what?
It's just on pizza.
It is. It absolutely is. So sort of leading up to that, you know, just like outside of, you know, of Apple at, you know, at the time, you know, the iPod was already successful, right? It was already this thing that was, you know, that, you know, kind of had a life of its own. It was one of the, you know, kind of the legs, you know, that was kind of holding up Apple, you know, at that point. And so there was, you know, there was sort of a general understanding that Apple had the ability to build small devices, right? They weren't just Apple wasn't just a PC company. And so, you know, and I'm sure you probably remember from that time, but phones, you know, and smartphones in particular, but really all phones were just shit. I mean, they were terrible. You know, and everybody, you know, even within Apple, we knew that, right? It was sort of okay, are you going to go buy the, you know, have you gotten the Trio? Oh my God. Yeah. I got the Trio. Yeah. It's okay.
It reboots, you know, when I make a call. It reboots when I answer a call.
You know, and then, you know, and there were these bizarro, you know, Blackberries that were out there, but if you really wanted to use email with it, then you had to go convince your IT department to go, you know, install this whole other box, you know, to work with it, the BlackBerry Exchange server stuff, you know, and so that kind of left it at, you know, like the Motorola, you know, I think it was like the T68i was sort of the close, or not Motorola, it was the Sony Ericsson. That's what it was. The Sony Ericsson T68i was kind of like the shit hot phone. even though if you use it, it was only because it was a color screen, you know, that you know, and so, this is like mid-2000s and we're talking about color screens and, you know, and these are the big advancements. I mean, there was danger. To be clear, there was the danger sidekick, which was just, I mean, that was like, you know, a generation ahead of everything else. And it definitely, it felt that way, you know, but beyond that, you know, but for whatever reason, that wasn't really taking off, you know, like I think it should have. But other than that, you know, it was sort of the, you know, well, hey, the phone market is all full of, you know, this janky crap. Apple knows how to build, you know, embedded devices. Why doesn't Apple build a phone? You know, and there were, you know, and you know, I remember having, you know, in particular, you know, I became pretty friendly with, you know, with one of the guys on the address book team, Scott Herz. And so we would hang out and, well, okay, now I'm going to give... My boss at the time really, really hated this kind of thing. But, you know, we had a bottle of whiskey in Scott's office and we would close up the door.
I knew I liked you.
Yeah.
Perfect. Yeah. So yeah, you'd hang out
We'd hang out and, you know, and have a glass or two and, you know, just shoot the shit and talk about this, you know, kind of stuff. And, you know, and whatever we would see, you know, forestall in the halls, you know, it was just sort of this general thing that we had, you know, kind of expressed interest around that, like, why isn't Apple making a phone? And, you know, we could do so much better of a job than, you know, you go around and show people, like, show people, you know, I'd go and show Scott, like, here, look, I just got this, you know, this BlackBerry. It's completely, you know, just horrible, but, you know, it does these two or three things that are kind of cool. Or, you know, or here's this, you know, I got the Sony Ericsson phone and yeah, look, it's color and oh, it looks so nice. We could do something better than this. You know, it was, but it wasn't like, you know, I wasn't actually like ever directly pitching him like, hey, we should, you know, we're your guys, you know, we're the ones who you should put on this thing. It was just more of a, you know, we were all just generally interested in technology, you know, and, you know, here was an area that was, you know, sorely lacking, you know, and so it just kind of came up naturally. Yeah. And so early in 2005, Scott Forstall came into my office and you know, closed the door behind him and said, how would you like to, you know, work on this new project where, you know, this you know, where we, you know, we have some designs for making a phone, you know, and I mean, it was just like, of course I want to do that. You know, it was, it wasn't even a question, you know, it was, you know, it was fantastic. I mean, I think, you know, the first couple of questions were, well, who else is going to be working on this? And, you know, and it became clear that, you know, I can pick a couple of people from, you know, from the mail and address book teams and, you know, and we're going to move up to the human interface design hallway and get to work on this stuff. And, you know, I hadn't even seen designs for this thing yet, but I had already said yes. You know, it was kind of of course, that's what I wanted to, you know.
Yeah, just the notion of it was so promising that just, you know,
exactly.
You got to jump in. Yeah.
Right. And, you know, and even the prospect of, you know, just starting something brand new and scary and just kind of, you know, just doing the learning all over again. You know, what does it take to, you know, build a phone and, you know, what, you know, and obviously we were going to do something different from, you know, from anything else that was out there, but, you know, can we be so different or, you know, how different can we actually be and still ship a viable phone? You know, I mean, immediately, you know, there was just kind of the rush of questions, you know, it was just kind of, how are we going to do this thing? We've never done it before. How much are the iPod guys going to be working on this? Can we leverage, you know, their expertise here? You know, what are the designs look like? Are they even practical? You know, just kind of at a, you know, first approximation, like, are they, you know, are they just so zany that, you know, we'll never be able to do this? Or, you know, is this something that we can make work? I mean, there's just a bunch of questions.
So were the first designs close to what shipped? Or was, like, how much fumbling did you guys do? I imagine there must have been a bunch of fumbling.
Yeah, it's interesting, though, because, you know, I mean, looking at, you know, from what I, and forgive me, this is part of the memory test. But, you know, the first things that I remember were, you know, so we went up to the human interface hallway and we met with, I think it was Scott Herz and I at this point, or it may have just been me, but I think it was Scott Herz and I. We both went up to Boss Ording's office, who's, you know, one of the, you know, sort of one of the, you know, the more prolific designers in the HI team. And he had been working on, you know, using Director, Macromedia Director, you know, just in Lingo, which is the kind of the Director scripting language. You know, he had created what were, you know, sort of the first look for, you know, scrolling contacts, you know, and he had it actually wired up to, you know, this tethered device that, by the way, was tablet sized. You know, it was a tablet form factor. It was tablet sized, but sort of pushed down into the corner was this, you know, was kind of the, you know, a phone like display was being rendered with this full screen, you know, list of contacts. And you could use, you know, use your thumb to kind of scroll up and down. And, you know, you could see kind of the different sections within the, you know, within the table, you know, the kind of the transitions between, you know, when you're looking at the A's and now you're looking at the B's and things like that. So I think a lot of the, you know, so there was that part of it. And then also what we sort of know today as the Springboard, you know, as kind of the look and feel for Springboard, where, you know, you kind of come out to this view, you know, this grid view of apps and, you know, you can launch things and, you know, kind of, you're always coming in and out of Springboard, you know, to kind of transition from app to app. So I think a lot of it was pretty similar to what we, I mean, just from looking, you know, stepping back and kind of looking at it, you can, you know, it looked very similar to what we ultimately shipped in 1.0. But of course, you know, a lot of the details around, you know, like the scrolling contacts and, you know, kind of, you know, some of the user interface elements were, you know, obviously very different. And, you know, some of the apps were a little bit more, you know, it was a big Macromedia presentation basically that was then rendered on this, you know, this tethered device, which was kind of this combined display and input device. And so, you know, some of the, you know, quote unquote apps were a little bit more fleshed out than the others, right? So, you know, if you tapped on something like phone, you know, you could easily go see your scrolling contacts or, you know, where other things were less, you know, kind of fleshed out. Like you tapped on Safari and it would just bring up a, you know, kind of a still shot of, you know, New York Times and the URL bar at the top.
Yeah. Bit of hand waving.
Yeah.
Exactly. But that's good. That's enough direction to, you know, help guide you.
Exactly.
So how did that process look like? Like, how do you recruit the team? Like, what's day one on that job look like when you're like, okay, well, I'm going to go build a phone. You sit down in a chair and then, like, what do you do?
Yeah, it was, first of all, it was, okay, where am I sitting and can I get badge access to that area? And, you know, after some of those details were worked out, you know, I think one of the funniest, you know, sort of early stories that we had was, well, let me step back a little bit. So, you know, I was no longer going to be the mail and address book engineering manager, right? I was about to go disappear and kind of, you know, go work on this other thing that nobody on the mail and address book teams knew about. And so that was kind of a hard, you know, hard thing to deliver. And especially at that point, because I feel like the mail team, like, we were really kind of firing on all cylinders. And we had, you know, we had just come off of this great, you know, kind of early, you know, demo session, like where we were showing, you know, we had an intern in, you know, we had a bunch of, you know, different things that we wanted to work on. And before Tiger was even done, you know, we had these demos that we wanted to show and sort of get on the books for the next release. And so, you know, there was already, you know, a bunch of work that, you know, had been going and, you know, we had kind of been, you know, moving in that direction. It's not like we had, you know, taken all this downtime after Tiger and kind of, you know, kicked our feet up and things like that. So that was kind of a hard message to deliver. And, you know, happily, I think the mail team has done, you know, very well since then. But anyway, so what ended up happening was I took, from the teams, from the mail and address book teams, I took, Scott Herz from the address book team, and then, two other engineers from the mail team. And we, you know, so I had I went from, I think, a team of 13 or 14 people to, you know, a team of three, you know, and we went up and, you know, all we had were designs. And, you know, we were now sharing and, you know, two of the, you know, my engineers were sharing an office. You know, I think I had an office, you know, over in the corner, but I was never in it. You know, and so, and we had these designs, but one of the funniest things that happened was, you know, I had access to these UI designs. You know, Steve Jobs at that time, I mean, he was very, well, not just at that time, I guess, he was very, you know, concerned about leaks, you know, around the human interface. And so he had to personally approve every name that went on the list.
Yeah. Yeah, I've heard that before. You try to get a guy on the team and it would just get stalled because Steve was busy. So
exactly.
You couldn't check the name. You couldn't check the name off. So it's like,
ultimate bottleneck.
And so at one point I actually had access to the HI designs, but two of the engineers on my team did not. So, you know, after talking with Scott Forstall about this and kind of explaining this sort of absurd situation we were in, you know, I sort of pitched him on the, well, why don't I just go in? So we're following, you know, the letter of the law here. You know, I'll go in and look at the designs. And then just based on my memory, I'm going to come back out, you know, to the office where my engineers are. And I'm just going to draw on a whiteboard, you know, sort of what, you know, what the mail, you know, and mail was one of the first.
Like a clean room implementation of what.
Exactly. Yeah. It was a clean room implementation, even though we all worked at Apple and, you know, we were, you know, probably 2 days away from everybody having access anyway, but, you know, but we needed to get moving. And, you know, and I even remember at that time, we were just kind of laughing at how absurd it was, but, you know, but here we were, and that's what we were doing.
Sure.
So a lot of the early work was, you know, we didn't have any hardware to run on. And so, you know, a lot of the early work was really, I mean, at that time it was still kind of a, you know, kind of a science project, you know, in some mm-hmm. ways. It wasn't really a, you know, we're going to throw the whole company behind this thing, right? It was really more of a, okay, we've got some designs, you know, Steve was finally happy with some of the designs he saw. And now, you know, let's start doing kind of the early studies and early, you know, kind of development to figure out, can we actually make some of these designs work? You know,
it wasn't really a product yet. It was more of a, like a lab situation, or were you sure that you wanted a product and you just weren't sure what the product was yet?
it was really, I mean, there was, I mean, there was a strong desire to have that product, but it was really not, it was not a slam dunk that, that those designs could be implemented. You know, at that time, you know, we were, you know, kind of the state of the art as far as Apple development was concerned was, you know, were these ARM processors that were really only capable of driving, you know, and again, this is my memory test. I'm probably going to fail it. But, you know, I think at that time we had, you know, just, I don't even think we had color iPods yet. You know, I think that we had, you know, we had the click wheels and we had the mini, but I don't think that we had, you know, color iPods, let alone, the iPod Photo and things like that. And so here we were on, you know, what we thought was going to be roughly equivalent hardware to what, you know, the current iPod was at the time. We wanted to do these full screen, you know, full screen compositing and have these, you know, animations, you know, running at least 60 frames a second and, you know, have these transitions from app to app and, you know, and how the hell would, you know, would you implement, you know, checking your email on an iPod? You know, I mean, it was just, you know, it's just these things that just seem like kind of, you know, just asking the question kind of seemed like it was an absurd thing to attempt.
Yeah, it's a bit of a preposterous project to jump in on. Yeah.
Right.
Was the touchscreen there day one?
Yes. Yes.
I think so.
For sure.
Yeah, you said you had the input device, right? Yeah.
Right. Right. The tethered device was sort of a combo. It was a USB input device, sort of, you know, with a display, kind of all integrated. You know, and it looked, I mean, you know, it functionally it was identical to what we know as the iPhone today. You know, sort of the input device was overlaid on top of the display. And so, yeah, we had that, or the HI team had that already, and they were, you know, they had already been playing with these designs and, you know, just trying to figure out what feels good in your hand. You know, is it actually viable to take over the whole screen and kind of use your thumb to kind of flick it? And, you know, can you make the scrolling, you know, the scrolling acceleration and deceleration feel, you know, physically true to life, you know, in some ways. And, you know, and then also how the hell are we going to do all of this on ARM class hardware? You know, and so, you know, and moreover, how was a team that was, you know, that consisted of engineers from the desktop operating system going to get this thing working?
Right.
You know, and that mostly came from kind of the iPod side of the world. You know,
you pulled a lot of embedded knowledge in there.
I'm sorry. What I mean to say is that there was a lot of skepticism from the iPod team that, you know, based on their limited understanding of what the user interface was and the fact that, you know, many of them knew that we wanted to build a phone, why would you pull desktop people, you know, onto a project like this instead of iPod people?
Well, why would you put OS X on a phone, right? That was going back.
Yes.
So how did that work out? I mean, you've got to train up a bunch of sort of desktop oriented developers into working in a very constrained environment. Was that troublesome?
Yeah, it was. I don't know if it was troublesome, but it was certainly troubling. You know, it was.
Sure.
You know, there was. I mean, at least for me, you know, I had kind of prided myself on, you know, on the fact that you know, any and every project that I had worked on at Apple up until that point was, you know, there were never science projects. They, you know, we always shipped. And so, you know, here I was on this, you know, what was effectively a science project at that point, because, you know, we had to run, you know, we had to do a lot of experiments around layer kit and you know, running that on, you know, GumSticks boards, which are these, you know, these little ARM boards. You know, running a variant of Linux to kind of prove to ourselves that, okay, if we have this kind of video hardware and at least this kind of, you know, this amount of RAM, that we can get 60 frames a second, you know, doing a full scroll. You know, but then there was the whole rest of the, you know, of the software stack and the fact that we were, you know, the fact that we wanted to use, you know, the you know, at the very least, we wanted to use a Unix style kernel. sort of underpinning this. And internally there was a lot, there was a lot of desire to use the mock kernel, use the OS 10 kernel, that there was a lot of skepticism, and it was a brand new project, and how the hell were we going to shoehorn the mock kernel onto this thing, let alone all of the apps and all the functionality, let alone with all of that, buffers that are large enough so that we can, composite, into, composite onto the display, all these awesome designs that we were seeing. So it was a little terrifying.
So you were totally terrified for 2 years.
Until we shipped.
Yeah.
We're going to take a quick break so I can tell you about our sponsor for this show, and that is lynda.com. Lynda.com helps you learn and keep up to date with your software, pick up brand new skills, explore new hobbies, and they do it all with easy to learn, easy to follow video tutorials. Whether you want to learn a new programming language, create a graceful user experience for your website, build your own iOS app, lynda.com offers thousands of video courses in a variety of topics. So, for example, I am trying desperately to learn how to edit this show in Logic Pro. I've been using GarageBand for a long time. Jason Snell makes fun of me. Dave Wiskus makes fun of me. But Logic just wasn't intuitive to me. So I've started to look at lynda.com to see how it works and how I can actually make that transition. And it saves me bothering Jason, saves me bothering Dave. It lets me feel like I'm in control of my own learning destiny, which is just the best thing ever. There's new courses all the time. They're running one for Linux for PHP developers now, Unity 2D Essential Training, Advanced Unity 3D Game Programming. Again, it is, you watch it from your computer, your tablet, your mobile device. They're broken into bite-sized pieces. So you can watch as much or as little as you have time for. And it includes searchable transcripts, playlists, certificates of course completion, everything that you need to be successful. Now, we've worked out a special deal with lynda.com to provide you with a special offer to access the entire library for 7 days. All you have to do is visit lynda.com/debug to start your 7-day free trial. That's lynda.com/debug. It's a fantastic service. I want to thank them for supporting us, and I want to thank you for supporting them.
Those 2 years must have been a little bit interesting. The most stressful 2 years of your life, or what?
Yes, absolutely. Absolutely. The most stressful 2 years that plus maybe the first like 3 months of managing the mail team, where it was, kind of the, learning to be a father and, learning to be a manager and, kind of, it's feeling like you're not really doing a great job at either one, but you're kind of, you got to keep going. But beyond that, I mean, yes, the from 2005 until 2007, I mean, even to this day, the fact that it took 2 years to go from, what we started with, which was almost nothing to, a shipping iPhone. Maybe I need to edit that because it's not almost nothing, right? I mean, we had Foundation and we had, a kernel and we had development tools and we had, very, very smart people. We had core animation or what would become core animation, to build on top of. But, but as far as, the kind of the architecture of, of the apps and how they interact with, with Springboard and how, things are implemented. I mean, there was almost nothing there. We had a great foundation, but I think that that's sort of a testament to, there's always been this very strong discipline within OS X to keep the layering of the system sort of honest and keeping it clean. In other words, your memory allocation system should never know about your graphics system, because you want your graphics system to use your memory allocation system, but you don't want, sort of the back references, right? You want to be able to use kind of those foundational pieces. And, it's really just at those times when you move those foundational pieces, to something wildly different that you kind of put them to the test. Did you actually get the layering right? And that's something that, I never knew about. I never learned before, you know, Avi and Bertrand and those guys sort of came in, and at first it really felt like, you know, when I was on OS9, you know, OS9 was, you know, and traditional Mac OS was, you know, in some ways it was more of a kind of a jumbled mess. You know, it was a very pragmatic implementation, let's say. You know, but you had things like, you know, your VM system that knew, you know, about how quick draw cursors work, you know.
Right.
And you know, teasing that stuff apart, it's very easy to kind of introduce those, you know, those kind of oddball dependencies. It becomes, you know, at least 10 times as difficult to remove them later. Exactly. But at those moments when you just need to get something fixed and you need to get something in, it's so much easier to do that, you know, to just violate that, you know, kind of the layering of your system and just to get your job done.
Right. But then, and that's when you write a comment saying, like, this really sucks and we should fix it. And then, like, it never gets fixed.
And it never gets fixed. Mm-hmm. A breadcrumb that is always there, you know, or a to-do that's always there.
Was there any bargaining over which apps you'd need to ship? Like, you know, you need Safari, you know, you need Mail.
Yeah, there was, let's see, bargaining. It wasn't really, you know, from those early designs, it was kind of a given that, you know, everything that we saw sort of in those early designs were things that we had to ship. So even, you know, as an example, you know, even things like weather and stocks, you know, which you might think are not, you know, the most terribly important things. It was just sort of understood that this is what, you know, is going to go onto the phone, you know, and now my team actually didn't develop weather and stocks. Those were kind of on the widget side, and we could have a whole discussion about, you know, sort of the selection process around the underlying frameworks and how this was implemented. But anyway, as far as, you know, to answer your question, I don't recall too much bargaining, you know, or anything like that. Now, I mean, there were some things that we didn't get exactly right, you know, with 1.0. You know, for example, MMS comes to mind.
Yeah.
Right? MMS was not there at all in 1.0, and we didn't really, you know, apologize for it. It was sort of, you know, internally, you know, we understood that there were these technologies that were sort of phone centric, that were kind of rough approximations of things that were available on other computing systems. Mm-hmm. And so, you know, like the WAP protocol, right? The web access protocol, which was sort of a stand-in for HTTP. You know, we knew that we were not going to support WAP. You know, it was just sort of why would we support WAP when we've got the full internet? You know, we've got Safari, you know, we've got the real deal here. We don't need WAP. And, you know, and WAP in practice, you know, I'm not sure if you remember from that time, but, you know, the browsing experience on any of these things, except for maybe it was horrible. It was so bad. You know, and that was part of what just made all of these devices just not very, you know, satisfying to use.
I had a Nokia flip phone and it had like an internet button that every now and then I would hit by mistake, and it would just make me angry because I couldn't figure out how to stop interneting. Like, oh, it was just,
it
was
Blazer
the worst.
I had Blazer and Pocket IE, so no sympathy there.
Nice.
Yeah, and it was just this alternate world, right? It was like not quite the web, but, you know, oh, look, I guess that's yahoo.com, or that's what yahoo.com wants to look like.
It looks sort of like an error page, or that thing you get in between two tags when it can't show what it wants to show.
Exactly. And so there were these things, you know, there were sort of the bad old days of kind of early, you know, phone development. And we had, you know, just like we weren't going to support WAP, you know, and we weren't going to apologize for it. It was just, no, we're building a new thing here. You know, MMS kind of fell into that same category. You know, we've got full email support. We've got full HTTP support. Why on earth would we include, you know, an MMS, you know, application, you know, and now, yeah, obviously in hindsight, you know, that was one that we, you know, we got wrong and we fixed it. I think it was in iOS 3.0. But, you know, but there wasn't, bargaining. you know, it feels like it would be so natural to bargain about some of these things, but I really don't recall.
That's the wrong word. I just, you know, because there's what you want and the realities of the time that you have to get it done in.
Yes, right. I don't recall, you know, even copy paste was, you know, it was something that was not there in 1.0.
Right.
But that wasn't, it wasn't because, oh, we have this great design and we just ran out of time. It was really seen as, you know, well, copy paste is kind of a holdover from computers, and maybe there's, you know, are we really sure that we want, you know, people editing text, you know, that much text on this phone? Like if you're getting to the point, if you've gotten to the point where you're, you know, farting around with, you know, fiddling with text and trying to copy paste things, and you're using this touch keyboard, you know, you already kind of lose, you know, it's already kind of a giant pain. So maybe we shouldn't, you know, maybe copying and pasting and maybe, you know, editing large amounts of text is just not something we want to support that well. And, you know,
and we think about for a while.
Exactly. Exactly.
Well, it's like be good at what you're good at for the initial release. Right. And then I guess you learn.
You learn. And I think that was a big part of it too, was, you know, this thing that we were releasing, you know, we had some ideas on, you know, obviously how we were using it internally, and that informed a lot of the decisions that we made before we shipped. But, you know, but at the same time, we knew that we were building something that was very different than anything else that had been built. And so to just take something like copy paste as a given, At that time, it seemed like, well, I'm not so sure that copy paste is such a given. You know, we're building this new thing. You know, yeah.
No, I think that's reasonable. I mean, you know, you also didn't expose a file system.
Mm-hmm.
Because why? You know, like exactly. It's exactly the right time to ask yourself, like, well, why are we doing this? Like, really, are we going to do it just because that's how computers work?
Right.
Or are we making this whole new thing?
So, believe me, I get into fights about the exposing the file system thing, you know, even to this day. I'm a firm believer in not exposing the file system, that, you know, if you go to anybody's, you know, you go to your mom's computer, or you go to your, you know, if your child has an account, what's the biggest thing that's just the hottest mess on their account? It's the file system. Mm-hmm. You know, they've got system folders copied into system folders. They've got documents upon documents. They don't know what they're going to open. They don't know when they can throw something away. You know, it's already this just gigantic cluster, you know, on a desktop machine. Why on earth would we want to expose users to that? And I've heard the other arguments too, right? You know, but anyway, I mean, on that.
Yeah. I mean, I consider myself an expert user, but I would also never pretend that my file system is neatly organized. Things are, but my desktop is a total mess, and, you know, documents is kind of arbitrary at times. So,
right,
whatever. Yeah. So when during that 2-year period would you say that you finally kind of settled on what it was that you were going to build? Was it earlier in the process, or was it kind of later?
It was to a large extent. It was earlier. I mean, we kind of knew early on, you know, what, you know, we had the designs in place, and we had enough, you know, discussions, you know, and iteration with the human interface team that we knew, you know, sort of what the design was that we were going for. And we knew at that point too, we had done sort of the proofs of concept. I never get that right. Is it proof of concepts or proofs of concept?
Of concept, I think.
Thank you. Okay. Proofs of concept. that sort of, you know, at least we were sort of, you know, convinced at that point that, you know, we had a plan and that we could, you know, we could hit it. So I really, you know, I think it was earlier, and it was really, you know, one of the things that kind of helped, you know, kind of build a little bit of confidence around, you know, around our plan was, that there was this other project called P1, that had started up. You know, and that was, I think, late 2005, maybe fall of 2005, where it was sort of, you know, it was decided that, you know, P2 was the release that we were working on. And I think we were already P2 anyway, which was kind of odd. But anyway, you know, it was the Purple Project was the, you know, was the software side of things. Mm-hmm. But you know, Steve Jobs and Phil and probably some other people, you know, had sort of, you know, and I think especially Tony Fadell at that time, who was running the iPod organization, had sort of decided that, you know, we need something out in the market before 2007. You know, that's just way too long to wait for something to come up. And we need something that's going to be sort of an interim device that we can release, you know, and get that out in the market and you know, learn from that while we're building P2 and while we're building this Purple software platform.
Oh, that's fascinating. Okay.
Yeah.
And I didn't know that. I'd always heard that described as a competitive thing.
Well, and it really, you know, I guess, you know, from I guess it depends who you ask, right? I mean, if you're on the, sure, you know, if you're in the executive team, you know, it's all Apple to you anyway, right? You know, and so, mm-hmm, you know, if you're looking, you know, if you've decided that you need this interim release to come out and it just so happens that, you know, the iPod organization is going to do the first one, you know, and sure, the OS X org is, you know, and CoreOS and, you know, is going to do the second one, that, you know, to that, you know, to those,
it's
people,
not competing at all. That's just a, yeah,
exactly. Right. You're all under Apple, but yes, to your point, absolutely. I mean, this felt like a, you know, I was on the, you know, I had been on the Purple team for a few months at that point and, you know, and was feeling good about some of the progress that we were making. And there was, you know, at that time, there was some us and them going on between the iPod group and the OS X group. I mean, there was some, or the Purple team, you know, there was some open questioning about whether or not, you know, we were the right team to deliver this thing. And, mm-hmm, you know, I mean, at that time, I think it was probably, fair to question whether we could do that.
Sure. Yeah, it doesn't seem irrational for the embedded guys to think that the desktop guys may not be able to pull off something of this scale.
Exactly. Not only, you know, I'm sure from their point of view, not only do are you trying to pull off something, you know, that runs on, you know, roughly this class of hardware, but you're trying to do something far more ambitious on the software side than, mm-hmm, you know, the iPod team ever had, and you have no experience doing either one. So,
right,
why do why should we believe that you can actually pull that off? And so, you know, it's hard. You know, I think, you know, we didn't really have a great answer for that, but I think that was one of the things that helped kind of drive us as well.
Well, yeah. Well, the answer shipped. That's the, you know.
Exactly.
You kind of proved it with the pudding on that point, right? So, yeah.
And that was one of the things that, you know, I think, you know, so this P1 project had started up. It was sort of late. From what I recall, it was late 2005 was when it had started up. And that was really, you know, now I don't know if this was, you know, some devious plan by Steve Jobs to kind of pit two teams against each other and, you know, make them hate each other and want to fight hard and work, you know, extra long and try to get this in. But, you know, if that was his intention, it absolutely worked because, you know, we wanted to, you know, so at that point, you know, anytime we had a milestone, you know, I was sort of generally, you know, paying attention to what, you know, what was happening on the P1 side. And what I really wanted to do was, you know, was make it so that, you know, I wanted to show working functionality on P2 before there was working functionality on P1. You know, and I wasn't. So, yeah, you know, I wasn't. Yeah. I didn't want to go in, you know, to your point, you know, I didn't want to just go in and talk, you know, and say, right, hey, we can do this stuff. Trust us. Look at this. You know, we can do whatever. You know, it was really, I just wanted to show that, you know, we could do this stuff. And it was a great sort of rallying, you know, effort for the group where I specifically remember. Oh, go sorry. Go ahead.
No, I was going to say nothing makes you feel more feisty than like a, you know, a battle cry, effectively.
Exactly.
Sorry, you specifically remember something?
Oh, yeah. I specifically remember it was over the, it was the holidays around, it was the holiday time at 2005. And, you know, we had just gotten, you know, like the comm center, the communication center, you know, kind of, mm-hmm, up and running. And that was going to be, you know, I believe from the time it was going to be a shared piece of code that was running on the P1 platform and running on P2. But anyway, we had it, you know, so we had it up and working on P2, and you know, sort of the rallying cry at that point was, we want to send and receive SMSs before the P1 team can send and receive SMSs. And we want to demo this to Steve before the P1 team can demo it to Steve. And that was one of those things that, you know, right around sort of Christmas of 2005, you know, it was one of those things that we had pulled off. You know, it was, you know, okay, this is the step that we're going to take. And I mean, and obviously it's something we need to do. You know, we need to do this to actually have a viable platform and to ship this thing someday. Sure. So it's not like it's throwaway work, but we can, you know, but let's just show that we're on the path to delivering these features before the P1 team is on that same path. And let's just, let's let other people, you know, one of those things that, you know, I guess this is probably a common sales technique, but you know, nobody can convince you, you know, more than you can convince yourself. You know, it's sort of one of those things where, as much as you can talk to, you know, someone like a Scott Forstall or Steve and say, hey, no, we're your guys, we can do this, we're going to work really hard, and we're going to do this, that, and the other, that just doesn't mean anywhere near as much. You're not going to convince them as much as, you know, by saying, you know, hey, why don't you come to this demo? We want to show you P2 sending and receiving SMSs. And let them, and we're not even going to mention P1. We're not going to say, well, where is P1? Have you seen the similar demo from P1? You must have seen this a month ago from P1 because, you know, they're the interim release and, you know, they must be ahead of us. Let them, you know, let somebody else ask all of those questions on their own and draw their own conclusions. And, you know, and I think that was one of those things. Yeah, that works.
That's great. It's like, it's basically having trust in their ability to realize the situation, rather than point out that, like, hey, we're ahead of those guys. You know, they're going to notice it. So just
be classy.
Yeah.
Exactly. Exactly. Be classy. Which is,
if you could win classy, it's the best thing in the world.
So I don't think we explicitly stated this, but you were the director of all of the apps at this point. Is that true?
So I didn't become a director until I think 2009. I was still, you know, title wise, I was still engineering manager until, 2009.
Sure. Okay. But I mean, the eggs were in your basket. Is that a fair way of putting it?
So almost all of the eggs. I certainly don't want to take credit for the work, you know, my peer, Richard Williamson. But I was in charge of the, you know, of, I mean, my group was, you know, it had a very nebulous title. It was PEP Apps. You know, it was Platform Experience Purple, and it was the apps team. And Richard's team was PEP Web, Platform Experience Purple, the web side of things. So Richard was really tasked with Safari, the WebKit backend, font rendering, maps, stocks, weather, and YouTube. You know, so it was sort of Safari and things that were closely associated to, you know, a web presentation were managed by Richard, and I had basically all of the other apps.
I don't want to be that's a little bit reductionist, but you had the native stuff and he had the stuff that had to talk to the web
kit stuff.
And initially that was the plan, was to ship, like the stocks widget, almost literally from OS X, just grab the stocks widget, put support into WebKit to make it so you could create, these things that kind of felt like apps, but obviously weren't, and we kind of know how that played out, after 2.0. But really the original plan was to make it so that stocks and weather and maps were these things that were really just widgets, sort of in the OS X sense of the word. But over time that, and certainly before we shipped 1.0, I remember there was a meeting where, Steve was kind of playing with some of these widgets and realized that they just didn't launch as fast as the native apps, and they didn't feel right, and they didn't, do all the things that the native apps did. And so, there was a quick scramble, to convert those all to sort of native apps, to get them off of, HTML and CSS and things like that. So yes, I had shipped, I think, my team had shipped it was probably like 70% of the apps, you know, kind of on the, you know, on the first release. And we, you know, roughly maintained 60 to 70% sort of through, you know, iOS 5.0, something like that.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
So how do you deal with stress? Because ultimately, I mean, yeah, the operating system and the you know, the framework stack and all of that is essential, but it's kind of the apps that people see, right? Like when, you know, in 2007, an iPhone ships, there's how many icons? Eight? Not even eight. There's nine? It's an odd number.
I'm rolling a bit.
Yeah, right. I don't remember that.
So, yeah, but, you know, a lot of that's on your plate.
Yeah.
Like the front-facing stuff. How's your drinking problem?
That was...
No,
that
I just...
going to be my answer was, how do you deal with stress? I drank. No.
Yeah.
a little bit, but not, you know, not too
right.
much.
No, no. I,
you know, I ate, you know, I certainly ate, you know, that was maybe a little bit of a problem. Everybody, you know, kind of on the, you know, on the iOS team at that point had, you know, sort of packed on way more pounds than they had wanted, you know, just from being in the office, you know, all day and all evening.
It's baby weight.
Yes.
product baby weight. Yeah.
That's, you know, that's interesting. I never thought of it that way. But yeah, exactly. I'm still fighting this baby weight, you know, I'm trying to get... as far as the stress goes, I mean, it's hard because I'm sure I didn't deal with it as well as I could have. You know, it was, you know, I certainly... You know, later on, you know, many years later, when I decided to leave Apple, it was sort of, you know, what one of the things that I had discussed with, you know, with my wife was, you know, was sort of those stressful times and how, you know, I would come home and I was just, you know, kind of grumpy. You know, I was, you know, grumpy with the boys. I hadn't seen the, you know, I have two kids,
yeah.
And you know, and I was, you know, and I hadn't seen them all day, and the only things that are coming out of my mouth are, you know, just barking at them, you know, that kind of thing. And right. So, you know, and it was, I mean, it was not easy. It was not a, you know, not a real pleasant time, mm-hmm. you know, as far as, you know, as far as family life goes. I mean, thankfully my wife was, I mean, she was, you know, she's always been just super supportive and super understanding and, you know, and, but, you know, but the truth is that, you know, I just don't think I was, you know, maybe handling it as well as, you know, I could. I mean, honestly, I don't know what I could have been doing to handle it better. You know, maybe, mm-hmm. you know, other than just, you know, having less responsibility over time. And I think that, you know, that was sort of, you know, in an organic way, that's sort of what ended up happening, you know, through the years, thankfully. but it's a hard thing. And, you know, I kind of got a taste for, you know, when, you know, we were talking earlier about wanting to go into management, wanting to have this influence and wanting to have, you know, more say over, you know, how these things are developed and what the feature sets are and things like that, you know, that there's certainly, you can have too much of a good thing, you know, and, you know, I think that I did for a while there. I mean, I wouldn't, it's weird because I, you know, looking back, I obviously I wouldn't trade it for anything, but at the same time, it was rough. It was pretty rough.
It was the best of times and the worst of times.
Was it continuously rough or was it up and down? I mean, like, were there milestones of roughness, like maybe the App Store or multitasking, or was it just a continual grind?
There were times when it was more rough than others. I mean, certainly during those first 2 years, you know, from 2005 until we had shipped, in some ways it kind of feels like a, you know, it almost feels like kind of a blur. You know, it almost feels like, you know, we were kind of careening from, you know, from crisis to crisis.
You survived it.
You know, and, you know, just trying to come up with, you know, the best answer for, you know, for the problem du jour or the problem of the week or the month, you know, and then it was kind of on to the next crisis. But at the same time, I mean, it was glorious too, right? I mean, it was kind of, you know, it's every engineer's fairy tale, you know, to work on something like this. So, you know, yeah, it's, I mean, it's a ton of work, but how would you choose to do anything else? You know, I mean, it was, you know, it kind of, you know, it was sort of this dream project, and, you know, and, you know, in a very selfish way, I wanted the project, you know, I wanted it, you know, I wanted to use this thing in the worst way too. And so, you know, you kind of, you know, you make those compromises, and, you know, as far as, you know, the quality time with kids and things like that. And, you know, and well, I think, you know, I was just hoping you can make it up later. I could make it up later.
Well, I think in a lot of ways, it's kind of like, a lot of people's life's work, right? Like you, when you notice a project like this, and you're like, well, this is it. This is, there's, you know, opportunities like that come along very infrequently. Yeah. Once a decade for like a handful of people. So
yeah,
it's rough. It's always rough, but it's rewarding ultimately in its own way.
Yeah, exactly.
Go ahead, sir.
Oh no. And, you know, and to, you know, complicate things even more. I mean, this was, you know, not only was it, you know, just kind of, you know, a dream project as far as, you know, getting to work on something that's so influential later, you know, to an entire industry and to the whole, you know, world in some ways. But, you know, it's also, you know, when I was a little kid, you know, it was, you know, Steve Jobs was, you know, if you liked Apple, you probably also knew the story of, you know, the two Steves, you know. And so now here I am, you know, later in life, like I couldn't even, you know, it wasn't even like my wildest fantasy to like get to be in a meeting, you know, with Steve and presenting something that's just groundbreaking. You know, it's sort of, you know, like I said, I mean, it's just, you know, that there, it really is just kind of a dream come true in so many ways. And, you know, it ultimately became too much of a good thing, but, you know, at those moments, you know, and it is, you know, how often do things like this come along, let alone are you at the same company where this thing is being developed? And are you even on the team? You know, are you in a position to work on those things?
There's, right, yeah.
You know, how do you say no?
Hey, there are these different narratives when it comes to Apple. Some people say, you know, when it comes to things like MMS or app stores or multitasking or now inter-app communications, that Apple changes their mind. And some people believe, no, it's a learning process. They see how people use it, and then they sort of go the way that customers are using it. And others say, no, it just takes a long time to make those technologies work. Is it one or the other, a combination of those things?
And forgive me for giving the least satisfactory answer. I think it is a combination of those things. You know, I think for some things it's learning, right? It's learning that, you know, on the MMS side, you know, learning that, okay, we can place, you know, WAP, you know, in this box and just say, we will never ever support this. And, you know, fuck all that old shit, right? You know, this is the new world. This is a new device. We're redefining things, right? And it's perfectly acceptable to say that for some, you know, technologies, but then, you know, you can't say the same thing for, you know, things like MMS, right? The reality of the world is that that's how people interoperate. And that's, you know, the network effect made it so that it was such a compelling pull to include MMS that frankly, we just got it wrong, you know, and we just didn't know at that time, you know, and it was probably also convenient, by the way, that, you know, if we didn't have to support this, you know, this kind of bulky specification for MMS, you know, in 1.0. I mean, I think it was self-serving as well, you know, but yeah, I definitely see that there's learning that takes place. And
I mean, you know, so with MMS, like the spec is one thing, but the UI is something totally different, right?
Yes.
There's a lot of work that goes into doing that correctly. So,
and the carriers, you have to placate.
Exactly. I mean, it was an enormous effort just all on its own by the time we had taken it on. And so, you know, it was very, you know, it made it so that we could ship this thing in, you know, in 2007 instead of 2008 or whenever. You know, and at that moment, you know, we had, you know, sort of made that decision, and it seemed like the right thing to do. And it was only later, you know, when you're sort of, you know, I think it's good to have, you know, kind of strong opinions on, you know, about, you know, when you make observations about, you know, kind of technology trends and things like that, you know, I mean, everybody gets them wrong at some point, you know, it just happens, right? And some people get it wrong way more often, you know, but I think it's okay to have, you know, have that strong opinion. And, and you know, and have justification for why you think that it's, you know, for why you're doing what you're doing. And if you need to adjust later, it's not, you know, I think it takes some, you know, and this is one of the things that I've always loved about Apple is just that, you know, there's a certain amount of humility that you have to be able to say, hey, we got it wrong. You know, here is the data that we took in. Here was the evaluation process. Here are the areas where things worked well. But then here's, you know, here are the things that we didn't take into consideration, you know, sort of the fact that everybody on the planet had a phone and they were already sending pictures, you know, and now they couldn't send pictures to their iPhone, you know, buddies.
Or like you said, with cut and paste or multitasking your interapp, you start making it more like a computer, and that those are very, those decisions have ramifications.
Exactly. Exactly. And it was only later that we realized that, okay, you know, I mean, you know, early on when we had developed this thing, you know, there was, I mean, it's easy to say this now, but it's hard to kind of place yourself back in that world that there really was nothing like it. Right. I mean, there really was nothing like the iPhone. And so when you're coming out with something that's so different, you know, you're it's hard to kind of anticipate where, you know, what are the things that are going to be important and what aren't. And it's only after, you know, I mean, how many people even understood, you know, the notion of multitasking on their computers, you know, let alone thinking that it was this thing that was super valuable that they needed to have on their phone. Right. I mean, nobody spoke about multitasking, as far as I can tell, before the Palm Pre came out. You know, it wasn't with the Danger device. Nobody mentioned that. It was certainly not with Blackberries. I mean, it just wasn't this thing that was on people's radars. It wasn't this thing that people, you know, gave, you know, value to. And Apple has always been very good about understanding what's valuable to users and putting all your wood behind, you know, those arrows that you've deemed valuable. And so just because someone, some person thinks that multitasking is cool and you can do it on a computer, that's just not enough reason to ever do that on your, you know, your kind of your marquee product. You know, you need a lot more justification than that.
Right. And for the amount of flack that Apple gets for being arrogant, I do think it's actually like a lot of humility in there. Like the fact that they will revisit the multitasking thing, but they'll do it in a slightly different way. Or, you know, eventually copy and paste will show up, even though maybe initially it was deemed, something that you wouldn't necessarily want to do on the phone. Or MMS. Like you guys, obviously you must have heard the MMS outcry and been like, yeah, you know what? We're going to get fine. So outwardly, Apple's often just painted with like the arrogance brush. But I do think that there's a lot more humility there than people give them credit for.
And patience, too. I mean, like you want interop communications, but you want it to be you want it to be secure. And so you have to get XPC over there. Then you have to get all these other elements in place so that you can have a really good implementation rather than just a really fast one.
Exactly. Exactly. Yeah, that's. You know, that's another thing that I think that Apple has been very good at is, you know, when they've decided to, you know, to actually take on something like this, they're not just going to go and fill out checkboxes, right? It's not just going to be a, hey, well, okay, Android apps can, you know, communicate with each other. So here, we're just going to crap out this little API. So now, you know, two things can talk to each other, right? They're going to, you know, there's a lot of homework that goes into, you know, any of these features. And, you know, and when you hear, you know, when you see sort of news stories about, you know, well, it's been so many years since Apple has done such and such, why haven't they addressed this glaring problem yet? You know, you can bet that there are, you know, that there are way more people than you can imagine inside of Apple who've already been harping on this for, you know, for a long time and are, you know.
Yeah, because they're iPhone users too.
Exactly. They're iPhone users. They're technology users. They want, you know, the best experience for themselves and their family. And a lot of times it's not obvious how to come up with the right answer. And they're patient, you know, like you said, Renee.
So I asked you how it felt to ship OS 10.0. How did shipping the iPhone feel?
I mean, it was enormous. I mean, I'm struggling to put it into words, you know, and maybe part of that is because, you know, my involvement on OS X was, I was on a relatively, well-scoped, part of, of the overall system. That was largely defined by people who came before me or my management or things like that. And certainly I had some input in that process, but it wasn't, but ultimately I wasn't, making some of the, some of the decisions as well. Right. Whereas with the iPhone, not only was I involved from the very beginning, but, we got to see it through to the end. And, and that's one of the other things that I love is that, good ideas come from everywhere, within Apple, and nobody is tasked with coming up with all the ideas. When you come up with an idea for, we're really going to, we're going to make these things separate processes because that's just the right thing to do on a Unix system, and let's not play games with, a single app launcher that, brings up different views or things like that. But that poses all these other problems. And how are we now going to solve those problems? It was just because you're involved from the beginning and you're kind of working through these issues. I mean, you guys, it's engineering. The more involved you are, the more it becomes your baby, And so this is my baby. It'll always be my baby. no matter how different it looks later, it's, I still remember it as, the little toddler, the chubby little toddler kind of walking along, learning to do new cool stuff. So, yeah, it's...
You know what? I don't think I've ever asked anybody on the team, but that initial reveal where Steve is doing it's an iPod, it's an internet communicator. What was the third one?
It's a phone.
It's a web browser?
Yeah, widescreen iPod, a phone, an internet communicator.
Yeah.
How did that feel? Like, did you guys just want to jump up and, pump your fist in the air or what?
Oh, yeah.
That must have been satisfying. Yeah.
It was, I mean, other than, watching the birth of my kids and getting married, that was absolutely one of the high points of my life, of my whole life, getting to... it was a combination of nerves, and I'm not going to kid you. You probably heard this. There was a flask being passed around.
I've heard that from a few people. I'm surprised there was only one, to be honest.
Not a keg.
But it was one of these things where, we knew what the demo script was, right? And we knew what it was going to be. And we had been working towards that for a while, certainly over the 2006 holidays. To get this thing ready, but it was relatively late that Steve had decided that he's going to do this sort of grand finale, and forgive me now, I don't even remember all of the pieces that were sort of tied together, but there was this sort of largely, kind of unified, kind of showing off all of the different pieces and kind of having them interact with each other. And at that point we were still, 6 months from shipping.
Well, it was really advanced multitasking. You had the music player fading out, the phone call coming up, him going to the web to email, back to the phone, back to his music.
I'm glad you remember it because for me it was just terror. It was just kind of, oh God, we knew that this, this, audio transition had caused some problems, or we knew that, this sort of fade of the scroll bar from, gray to black, could be a little glitchy there are all the things that, as you're going through it, you've gone through this demo, dozens of times yourself and the areas that are a little bit more wobbly than the others. And so, that's the terror part, right? Is just watching, your boyhood hero up on stage showing this thing that, he thinks is as cool as you think it is, to the whole entire world, and knowing that it's going to be on newspapers, the next day, just everywhere, and hoping that it doesn't fuck up.
Right. So I can't remember which part it was. It could have been the web stuff or it might have been music. But at one point, he just went off script. Like he either picked a song just because he wanted to hear it, or like he went to a different website. And I forget what it was, but... somebody I knew was telling me, and it's like the heart just sank, like, holy crap, I can't believe this could go so horribly wrong. But it worked out. It actually managed to work, and it was like, okay, phew, that take a swig from the flask and move on.
Exactly. Yeah. Maybe it's sort of a PTSD thing that I just don't recall, you know, specifically where he went off script, but I remember that later too, you know, and.
Yeah. Fun times.
Yeah.
So how was the group after that? I mean, you must have been sitting on top of the world for a while.
Yeah.
But then you had to do the SDK. Like, things got a little bit painful, right? Like, but you must have felt so good for years.
Oh, it was phenomenal. I mean, it was just great. I think there was the high of the, you know, of the keynote, right? And thankfully everything went so well, you know, during the keynote, and everything, you know, everything worked out, and you know, people got good and drunk after that, and you know, had some fun, you know, and there were some, you know, a little bit of vacation time that some people, no, they didn't take any vacation time because it was right back into, well, now that it's demoed well, now we've got to ship this thing, right? Mm-hmm. So even after January, after, you know, coming off the high of, you know, of a keynote that went well, then we had to actually put this thing in a box and ship it. And that wasn't going to happen for 5 more months.
And you were adding apps. I think the YouTube app came after the demo too.
Yeah, that's right. That's right. Now that was more on the, and that was, to be fair, that was on Richard Williamson's side. So, you know, I probably, you know, it's probably not fair for me to, yeah, you know, that was more, that was on his side, and you know, I'm going to give myself a pass for not referring too many details on that. but it was really, you know, okay, the demo went well. Now we got to ship it. You know, let's you know, but it became a new form of, you know, kind of terror, right? It was sort of the, you know, this thing. Now we need to make it so that, you know, everybody can do the Steve demo, right? It's not just a, right, you know, a well rehearsed, you know, don't fall off the rails on this part, or please don't touch that part, or you know, and you know, to his credit, he was very good about that kind of thing. But now we, you know, but then the new, you know, the new hurdle that we had to clear was, you know, everybody wants to use this thing, and everybody's going to be using it, and we have to make it so that, you know, we don't have any, you know, horrible glitches on day one, you know, that, you know, we need to, you know, we need to make it so that, you know, the thing that's always kind of bothered me a little bit about demos is that it's so easy to make a demo look so much better than the actual shipping product, you know? Yeah. And this has been a, you know, I've been a car fan, you know, ever since I was a little kid. And it always just made me apeshit that, you know, Ford or GM or these companies would show just these sexy cars, you know, at whatever auto show, these concept cars. And then they would release these dumpy looking, you know, things at the dealership, you know. It was sort of the, you know, the difference between, you know, the thing that they want you to believe and the thing that they're actually giving you is just, it's just, there's just like the Grand Canyon in between them.
Well, everybody, you know, wanted to do CoverFlow. Everybody wanted to do Pinch and Zoom immediately.
Right. Right. You know, and everybody wanted to make a phone call and have their music pause and be able to, you know, go browse the web or do these things. You know, it was just, you know, everybody wanted a seamless handoff between Wi-Fi and, you know, Edge or, you know, whatever it was at the time.
Edge.
You know, it's
Edge.
Edge. I threw up a little in my mouth right there.
It's not your fault.
but now that's the next hurdle to clear, right? Is, you know, you come off that high, it feels great, you can kind of ride that high for a few days, but then the reality of shipping this thing kind of set back in. And it was with us until, you know, we got technical approval, which was, I think, you know, in April or May of, I think it was May of 2007. Mm-hmm. Maybe it was even June. It's a blur at this point.
Yeah, close enough. Good, close enough for rock and roll.
Yeah.
So how did the organization sort of proceed post-launch? Like, what was the, like, pre-launch for those 2 years, obviously the driving thing is we're going to put out this phone and we've got a terrific vision for it that seems to be established pretty early in that cycle. As soon as you launch it, there's a, you know, a party, and then all hung over the next day. What's the feeling? It's like, what's the next goal?
Uh, So the feeling was, I mean, obviously it was fantastic. And that was really when, you know, the big part, when we had the big parties and, you know, some people maybe embarrassed themselves a little bit, you know, during those parties. And I don't want to name any names or anything like that. But yes, there, I mean, it was just a lot of partying. It was a great sense of relief. And especially when we got, you know, the big thing that we had been pushing for was technical approval by AT&T. You know, that was really kind of the, you know, it wasn't really seen as, you know, we weren't doing a kind of a release to manufacturing or a, you know, all of the decision makers have said, you know, yes, this is a good release, ship it and, you know, get it out there and what have you. Really for us, the big thing was technical approval. You know, we had been focused so much on, you know, we had these giant Excel spreadsheets, you know, from AT&T describing all of the requirements, you know, of this phone. And we had been in, I mean, just countless meetings with, you know, with them as well, you know, sort of talking through various details about how, different features work. And so there was a lot of, you know, sort of hand-wringing around, you know, technical approval. And in addition, there was sort of the, you know, the inevitable, you know, kind of futzing around with the UI that, you know, I don't think Steve could help himself. You know, he just wanted to do that kind of thing. And so, you know, that always gives engineering managers and project managers headaches. But yeah, I mean, it was, you know, it felt great for a while. Everybody got drunk. Everybody was very happy. But then I think the next hurdle was international, right? It was sort of the European rollout. I think that was a release called Oktoberfest. Because we wanted to ship kind of September, October timeframe. So it was really not too much time between, you know, receiving technical approval from AT&T, which I believe came in May or maybe early June 2007, and, you know, shipping a European ready version of the iPhone.
Yeah. So was that a Canadian one too? Because I bought an iPhone just because I couldn't help myself.
Uh-huh.
I'm in Canada, and I couldn't activate it, and all I could do was dial 911, and I swear to God, I was so tempted. I was so tempted. And then, like, whatever, I managed to jailbreak it and get it real. But yeah, it felt like there was, like, three, four, maybe, like, it felt like a long time. To you, it must have been a very short window to, you know, to roll out that extra set.
Yeah, it was, yes, and to me, it did feel like a short amount of time. I think we rolled out with O2 in the UK, Vodafone in Germany, and maybe Orange in France.
Yeah.
You know, I think those were the three that came out sort of roughly in the, you know, late 2007 timeframe. I don't recall. Yeah. There may have been a Canadian release. Like
the iPhone 3G we got. That was the first one for us.
Yeah, it was, you know, it was definitely. So one of the things that happened, like, right after release, actually, and it may have even been like right after, you know, sort of the January demo, was there was, it's funny, I don't know if it's, you know, paranoia or if it's just sort of, you know, an understanding about how the world works that I was just exposed to, but it was definitely made clear that there's, you know, people at Apple definitely felt like there was sort of a whisper campaign against the touchscreen, you know, and using touch as input for the iPhone, and even at that time there were a lot of parallels that were drawn sort of to the Mac in, you know, kind of in the 80s where
dismissive, you know, of the mouse kind of thing.
Exactly, yeah. Exactly. Being dismissive of the mouse and feeling like, oh well, maybe that's a consumer toy type thing, but, you know, serious businesses will never use that kind of thing.
My
right?
company will never ship anything called a mouse.
That's what
Xerox said.
Xerox said that.
Yeah.
Right. You know, it was, you know, and that seemed like, you know, and that was the party line for a lot of Apple's competitors back then, you know, right up until they got to the point where they had a windowing system and wanted to ship this thing, right? And then there was, hey, look at our cool stuff too. Then all of a sudden the message switched, right? And so there was definitely, you know, some awareness around the fact that, you know, Apple was coming out with this touch-based keyboard, you know, and touch for text input, where, you know, sort of the leading phones in those categories, you know, I think it's fair to say it was the Trio and the BlackBerrys, And maybe there are some shitty Nokias in there too. I'm not really sure. But you know, all of those phones had physical keyboards, you know, and even the Danger device had a physical keyboard. And, you know, as much as we did, you know, a lot of hand-wringing internally around, you know, making it so that this touch keyboard actually does what you want it to do and what you expect it to do, you know, there was a lot of concern that, you know, are people really going to adopt this? You know, is there, you know, we internally knew that we could use this thing and we were, you know, pretty productive on it. But is that just because we, you know, put in the, you know, kind of the above and beyond time to learn how to do this thing? And are normal people going to want to do it? I mean, there's a lot of awareness within Apple that, you know, not only are people dogfooding things, but at the same time, they're also, you know, kind of second guessing the fact that they're dogfooding because, right, you know, they're not normal.
Well, it's a fear of acclimatization to poor circumstances, right?
Yes.
Like you are dogfooding, but ultimately you don't want to be eating dog food. You'd really rather be eating a good steak. And so if you just get used to eating dog food, then, you know, ultimately the product suffers from that.
Right. Right. You know, and after a while, and humans are so adaptable, you know, and humans are so good at, you know, you live next to a dump for a while, you don't even smell the dump anymore. Right. Mm-hmm. You know, so, you know, there was a lot of concern that, you know, well, is this keyboard, you know, or is this keyboard kind of like living next to a dump where, okay, you've gotten used to it now and it's pretty good, but you live next to a dump. How are you going to convince, you know, Joe Schmo to move in next to a, you know, move next to a dump, right? You know, it was sort of, there was some second guessing, you know, internally that was taking place. But there was also just sort of this fear of kind of this, you know, this, you know, it was described to me as this whisper campaign, you know, about the viability of using touch devices for, you know, can professionals really use that kind of thing? And, you know, and it turns out, exactly. Turns out, yes. But, you know, there was a lot of concern at that time. And, you know, and there was definitely a lot of awareness of, you know, the fact that Apple was, you know, we had a lot of success with iPods, but by and large, we were a PC company. And even some of our competitors like Palm, you know, called us out as PC companies. I mean, they were famously wrong at this point now, you know, or they were later.
Yeah. So did that get your back up? There was a lot of people saying kind of like, or being at least dismissive about Apple being able to enter like the, you know, the phone market or the embedded market. Did that, you know, make you a little bit feisty?
A little bit, you know, it's, you know, but I think it was one of those things, you know, at that time, I think it was even still true at that time at Apple where you were kind of used to being the underdog, you know, you're kind of used to not everybody believing your story or wanting to buy into your story. You know, I mean, there are so many, I can't tell you how many times, you know, I've had, you know, just in casual conversation and especially during the dark days at Apple where, you know, I would tell somebody, yeah, I work at Apple, and they would look at you like, are you too dumb to get a job somewhere else? You know, like, or are you, you know, are you just buying into some religion that, you know, I just can't possibly understand, you know?
Right. Yeah.
So there's a lot of, you know, I, and by the way, I think this is one of the things that worries me a little bit about the new Apple is that, or Apple these days is, you know, I really hope that there are still those people there who, you know, sort of hold to their convictions, you know, in the face of, you know, a whole world that's against you, because at this point it doesn't feel like the whole world is against Apple, you know? And so it's easy to get sort of complacent and maybe feel like everything you're going to do is a success. And so
that's interesting. Cause I think I was about to say, at least I feel from the outside community that, there is still that underdog current going on.
Good.
Which, well, yeah, is good and can be bad in that I think maybe people don't appreciate that Apple now is a huge company. And so that, at least from the outside, from the external developer's perspective, things are changed a little bit, you know? So I think people need to appreciate that the Apple you started with that would never ever break Super Boomerang is not that Apple anymore, right? So people should be adjusting their expectations accordingly. That said, I love that you want to, and I think it's important that Apple does remain feisty and does not become complacent with their success.
Right, right. It's, you know, and you know, maybe for some of this, you know, I think a lot of my concerns are, you know, sort of, you know, in a very, admittedly, in a very simplistic way, I'm sort of drawing parallels to Microsoft in the mid-90s, where, you know, Microsoft, you know, they were this, you know, they were this feisty company. They had, you know, they had these releases that were, you know, kind of famous for being crappy, but then they also had releases that were famous for being just wildly successful. And they, you know, and to their credit, they sort of, you know, they brought computing to, you know, to people who could never afford a Mac, you know, or who could never, you know, who just weren't willing to pay that much money for this thing that they maybe didn't see as being valuable.
I was never a fan, but they did a good job.
Exactly. I mean, I hated it. I could never, you know, use a Windows machine. It was just awful. But, you know, and, you know, but to their credit, I mean, they fought through that, and they fought, you know, the people who were, you know, there was that culture of, you know, kind of, you know, you've got to keep fighting, and you've got to kind of be, you know, the whole world out there is critical of what you're doing. And so the best way to kind of tackle a lot of that is to be your own worst critic. You know, you want to come with the answers, you know, that, you know, you're going to be asked, you know, or for the questions, you know, you're going to be asked. Right. And if you're complacent, or if you believe that everything you're doing is going to be successful because you work at this badass company, you're not going to do that, you know, or you're not going to have the drive to do that. And so that's where I worry a little bit. But I mean, I feel much better having seen, you know, this WWDC and sort of seeing the effort that's gone into, you know, a lot of the, you know, into iOS and into Yosemite. You know, these are the points where it would be very easy for Apple to just kind of phone it in and just kind of, you know, Samsung their way into,
exactly,
you know, into a new release. You know, make the last thing, you know, make the new thing look exactly like the last thing, because hey, the last we couldn't make enough of the last thing, so why would we diverge from that? You know,
right? Was this the first year that you didn't know what was coming into the keynote? I imagine. So wait, you've been out of Apple what? 2 years now?
I left Apple in early 2012. So this is my third WWDC not as an Apple employee.
Okay. Imagine the first one you pretty much
knew
what was coming, right? The second one, maybe a little bit. So was this like a brand new thing for you?
There was a lot more that was brand new, you know, this year. You know, it's funny because I'm still friendly with so many people who are now, you know, working on these new efforts you know, and I don't ever want to put them in a position where they feel like, you know, they have to say, I can't tell you. I know they can't.
Yeah.
Right. And they're doing
that's
their
part
job.
Of the dance. It's like, I got a lot of friends there, and I'm basically just asked, like, are you happy? And they say yes or no. And that's pretty much it. Like, you know, you can't get into anything, but
right. Yeah. And am I going to be happy to see the thing that you're working on? You know?
Yeah. Like, yeah. You try to talk in vague terms. So.
Right. So yeah, every year that's gone by, it's been a little bit more, you know, I'm a little bit more detached from, you know, from what's coming in. And to everyone's credit who, you know, who is still at Apple, they're not telling me, which is they're doing their right job. They're doing their jobs, which is great.
Yeah.
So 4 hours in, we're 2/3 of the way through with Nitin Ganatra. Please join us next time as we finish off with the iPhone to the iPad and what comes next.